Welcome to Just Us and the Climate, a podcast by the Climate Justice Coalition, where we bring climate change back down to earth and show how it's not only a crisis, but an opportunity to build a better and more just world.
So welcome back to Just Us and the Climate. Today's episode is a deeply important and urgent conversation at the intersection of international law, climate justice, and global solidarity. We're looking into the question of Palestine, not only as a site of ongoing struggle for self-determination and dignity, but as a lens through which we examine the responsibilities of states beyond their borders. Joining us today is Roshan Dadu, the coordinator of the South African BDS Coalition, and Saran Sheikh Khan, who has authored a compelling legal advisory report exploring South Africa's obligations in relation to the continued export of coal to Israel. The report argues that in a context where international crimes, including apartheid and genocide, are being documented, states like South Africa cannot remain passive, where they have to act and have the power to act, especially as it relates to the country's continued support of coal to Israel. Together, we'll unpack what the law means, what it says, what accountability demands, and what it means for South Africa to align its constitutional values and to its actions. So welcome, Roshan and Saran.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So let's give you a chance to just introduce yourself, Saran, and then Roshan, and we'll take it from there. Afterwards, we'll move on to the questions.
Thanks, comrade. Yeah, so my name is Sirhan, and I'm a lawyer. My general expertise has been for the past few years in litigation and administrative law, and now international law, pretty much. And I'm lucky enough to have had the opportunity to work on this report with many other comrades that have really done the most. And we are hoping that, you know, now that we've prepared this report, that we can stop these exports.
Thanks. Roshan, over to you. Short introduction.
Thanks. I'm Roshan Dadu. I'm, as was said, the coordinator of the South African BDS Coalition. The coalition brings together different Palestine solidarity organizations to focus campaigns around boycotts, divestments, and sanctions, which the Palestinian-led global movement called on the international community for in 2005 already, in line with exactly the demands that South Africa, we made during our struggle on the international community for boycotts, divestments, and ultimately putting pressure on governments to impose sanctions. So we know that this strategy works as a tool of solidarity. A few years ago, after in the genocide in Gaza, Israel started committing the crime of genocide in Gaza, we looked at our exports and imports from Israel, because we have absolutely no policies around boycotting, divesting, or imposing sanctions. And we saw that coal was our number one export. So in line with the global campaign for an energy embargo, we started looking at how can we raise up this issue here. And eventually this led us to think, given that there was no response from government to even our requests for meetings, we needed to take legal action. And very fortunately, Comrade Sahan was able to really make an argument in this dossier that we've presented last week to the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition that is so thorough, so fully referenced and consulted not only with South African legal people and international law experts, but also Palestinian international legal experts. So we're excited to see how this process unfolds.
Thank you, Roshan, for that comprehensive introduction and laying the groundwork for where we go next. So let's jump straight into the questions. Question for you, Saran. To begin, can you briefly walk us through the core argument of your report? What is at stake in South Africa's continued export of coal to Israel?
The report titled Fueling Genocide is an analysis of the relationship between South African coal and the genocidal state of Israel. It provides both a factual and legal analysis of this relationship and how South African coal literally fuels the ongoing genocide, illegal occupation, apartheid, and other crimes against humanity. At its core, the report makes a simple but legally decisive point. South Africa is not a bystander. It is part of a supply chain feeding Israel's energy system, in turn feeding and fueling its genocide, fueling its illegal occupation, fueling the apartheid, fueling the ethnic cleansing, theft, torture, rape, and colonization of Palestine. Coal exported from South Africa is used in power stations in Israel that feed into its national grid. Critically, the Israeli electricity grid sustains its genocidal military operations, illegal settlements, and in doing so, it entrenches the illegal occupation that is unlawful under international law. In 2025, South Africa became the largest exporter of coal to the genocidal Israeli regime. Coal-generated electricity made up at least 26% of apartheid Israel's total electricity capacity. All of this after Colombia, South Africa's co-chair at the Hague Group, imposed a full coal embargo on Israel in line with its international obligations. The president of Colombia specifically stating that the reason for the coal embargo was to ensure that Colombian coal is not used to kill Palestinian children. You may recall that on the 4th of March 2026, the Hague Group members of about 40 states met at The Hague in Netherlands and confirmed that they would use all legal mechanisms available to them to try and stop the Zion Nazi regime from continuing to genocide, bomb, starve, and commit international war crimes. Yet, very controversially, we are now fueling the genocide by providing Israel with more coal to carry out its energy-intensive genocide against the Palestinians. What has effectively happened now in this case is that South Africa, by filling the vacuum left by the Colombian coal embargo, has effectively rendered that embargo ineffective, so to speak. So these issues are not abstract, and I think that the pertinent question now is whether South Africa can continue to allow the supply of critical inputs such as coal into a system while knowing that serious international crimes, war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, apartheid, torture, and the list goes on and on. Can and should our government still be allowing our coal to go into the system? From a legal perspective, and the argument that we make out in the report is that once government has knowledge of the crimes this genocidal regime is committing, and once it has the evidence of how its own resources and conduct fuels this genocide and these international crimes, continuing that trade exposes both the state as well as the private actors who sell the coal to potential complicity in these ongoing crimes against humanity committed by the genocidal state of Israel.
Thanks, Aran. For context, we want to remind the listeners that we have prepared this advisory as civil society, quite a formidable dossier. 263 pages at last count. We delivered it to the Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, DTIC, and we have given them a time limit to respond. We'll return to that later. So, Roshan, this question's for you. The report situates Palestine within a long history of dispossession and struggle. Why was it important to ground the legal argument in this broader political and historical context?
Well, basically, because international law doesn't operate in a vacuum, and the legal duties that we're talking about in the report, non-assistance, non-recognition, prevention, ending complicity, are triggered by context and not isolated events. Palestine is, as we know, not a conflict zone. It's a situation of prolonged settler colonial illegal occupation, forced land displacement since 1948 and before, systemic discrimination amounting to a very harsh and violent, harsher than even in the case of apartheid in South Africa, a form of apartheid. And, of course, for the last 2.5 years, of full-blown genocide, which has been live-streamed to people all over the world. And now, as we speak, the illegal war against Lebanon and against Iran. And all of these crimes are well documented, and all of them are recognized in various forms by international bodies. Of course, you know, we were so proud of South Africa for standing up and taking the case against Israel at the International Court of Justice under the Genocide Convention. And so we ourselves have brought about additional, in fact, legal obligations to prevent and to punish that crime. And of course, the advisory opinion that followed that, that determined the occupation is illegal. And after that, the United Nations General Assembly resolution that was passed by a supermajority of countries, which actually does call on third-party states to start to impose measures of sanctions in order to compel Israel to end its impunity and for us to end our complicity in the most heinous crime of crimes, or that of genocide in particular. But as you can see, it's not just about the genocide. It's international law that has come into being, in fact, since 1948. So they're very important points to make. For Israel to completely comply with international law, it must completely dismantle the illegal occupation, remove all illegal settlements, end the racial discrimination and domination, the system of apartheid over the people of Palestine from the river to the sea, and very importantly, for the right of Palestinian people to return to their land and their homes that they were forcibly and violently displaced of over the past century. The provision of compensation and reparations is another issue that needs to come to the fore at the moment, especially for the harm they've suffered, not just now, but over these many long decades of oppression and apartheid and illegal occupation. So without understanding our arguments within the historical context of Palestinian dispossession, ethnic cleansing, and what we call the ongoing Nakba, there cannot be justice. And so we set the historic context because it must be understood that South Africa cannot and must not engage with Israel until there is equality and justice, and there can be no justice without the return of the Palestinian land. And in fact, the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement also says we must push for boycotts, push for divestment, push for sanctions until the Palestinian right to return to their land, as stipulated in international law in UN Resolution 194, is able to come about.
Thank you for that comprehensive answer, Roshan. As the founder of the Movement for Debt and Reparations, this idea of reparations resonates with me. We'll return to that question in a later episode, hopefully. I have a follow-up question for you, Roshan. You argue that trade, particularly coal exports, form part of the infrastructure sustaining Israel's military and industrial systems. Can you explain how seemingly distant economic activities become implicated in international crimes? Can you tie that together for us?
For one thing, I mean, of course, there's a call for an arms embargo, and some countries, even some European countries, have started to ensure that they are not selling weapons to Israel. And also some countries have implemented regulations to stop ships carrying weapons from docking at their port. But international law doesn't only regulate weapons, it also regulates all forms of material support. And coal in particular, it's not just a commodity, it's an energy input. So it is considered a dual-use item. In fact, in the last Hague Group meeting that Sahan referred to, they specifically emphasized dual-use items and energy as sources of energy as one of those. Obviously, it provides Israel with the capacity it needs to use its high-tech smart AI weaponry, which is used to kill Palestinians indiscriminately by the touch of a button, which is used to power illegal settlements while controlling and denying Palestinian access to electricity, While it refers to Palestinians in Gaza as human animals and has cut off all forms of infrastructural support, particularly without electricity, hospitals are struggling to function, sanitation plants don't run, if not all already destroyed, by the way, and Palestinians are left to suffer and survive, not only under constant bombardment, but also without electricity when it is so critical to their survival. So energy is what allows a state to function, and a military-industrial state like the state of genocidal state of Israel obviously needs a massive supply of energy, even more so now as it's extended its illegal war into Lebanon and into Iran and is now moving ground troops into Lebanon further and further north. So if they intend to try to settle there, which I think is their objective, obviously, it's expanding the Israelis' need for electricity while they're still cutting off electricity from Palestinians in Gaza and selling electricity at higher prices to Palestinians in the West Bank. So if you're supplying a resource that powers the national grid and that grid supports the genocide, illegal occupation and apartheid, then your conduct, i.e. us, South Africa, our conduct, can amount to aid or assistance in maintaining that apartheid system, as well as aiding and abetting all the war crimes and crimes against humanity that Israel is committing. And so that's an important point to make, because it means we, as South Africa, are complicit in all of these internationally acknowledged crimes. So legally, the threshold is knowledge and a contribution that is not insignificant. You do not need to intend the harm. And that's an important point to make. You only need to know the context and continue contributing to it. And that's what transforms ordinary trade into unlawful legal conduct. And so when we're calling for a coal embargo, we're saying we want to end our complicity as South Africa. We want to isolate Israel as the objectives of our call as well for sanctions against the apartheid state of South Africa. And it's what transforms ordinary trade into unlawful legal conduct. We are literally breaking international law by continuing, and even now it seems escalating, our sale of coal to Israel.
And this kind of complicity that is now evident in the report, and the report highlights where we are complicit, that complicity is totally at odds and diametrically opposed to South Africa's moral high ground of its position at the ICJ case, and this is what we are trying to expose. Of course, let's return to the legal domain. Saran, what are South Africa's specific legal obligations under international law and its constitution when it comes to preventing complicity in these kinds of violations?
Thank you. Roshan gave a very good understanding of where the causation and how basically the fact that the coal is fed into the system and which is then used to carry out all of these crimes activates a whole long list of international obligations and duties, both for South Africa, the government, as well as private actors. And all of these, this entire legal argument has been set out in the report. But in short, South Africa's obligations are clear and strong. Under international law, there's a duty not to aid or assist in internationally wrongful acts such as genocide, apartheid, illegal occupation, and the lot. A duty not to recognize unlawful situations which come about when South Africa trades with Israel, because often these companies are exporting to Israeli settlements which are illegal under international law, and by allowing this trade to take place, it's a form of recognition that we are okay trading with an illegal entity. And then there are also positive duties which come about from international law when there are serious breaches of the law. So all these duties come from a long list of international treaties and frameworks, including the Genocide Convention, which requires government to prevent and punish the genocide. In this case, operatively, the requirement to prevent genocide, one of the pressure points we are calling on government to implement is stopping the coal, because it will cut off a large, 26% last year of Israel's electricity capacity. Then the Geneva Conventions, which require South Africa and states to respect international humanitarian and human rights law. Every country that's a member of the Geneva Conventions has that right to uphold and respect international law. The ICJ's 2024 advisory opinion on the occupied Palestinian territories, which demands that no state recognize the unlawful situation of the illegal occupation, nor render any aid or assistance to it, which coal is. In addition, in September 2024, as mentioned by Roshan, that the UN, through the General Assembly resolution, called on all states to do what they can to ensure Israel complies with its international obligations, including by cutting off trade with the illegal apartheid entity. But in our case, and through this report, what comes through very critically is how international law is domesticated in our country. So domestically, international law obligations and duties are directly binding through the constitution of South Africa. Section 7.2 of the Constitution requires the state to respect, protect, and promote and fulfill the rights in the Bill of Rights, which includes the rights to, number one, life, which is sacrosanct, the right to equality, the rights to human dignity, the right to a safe environment. Section 39, which then requires courts as well in their interpretations of statutes and the law to consider international law. But most critically is sections 232 and 233 of the Constitution, which specifically states that international law is incorporated as binding law in the country unless it is in conflict with the Constitution or in conflict with any statute of law, which it is not. And furthermore, international law must guide the interpretation of statutes within the country. So there's ample constitutional court case law on these issues confirming that, you know, the role of international law in South Africa. But I think most importantly is the prohibition against genocide is what is known as a peremptory norm of international law, or Jus Cogens norm, and that is a non-derogable prohibition. And what that means is that the prohibition against genocide cannot be balanced against, for example, commercial interests, because, I mean, the duty and obligation to stop a genocide, I mean, far outweighs any other corporate or commercial interest, so to speak. So through the report, we set out these are the main arguments, that, but it's extremely comprehensive to include the laws around corporate complicity and what are the duties and obligations of corporates in terms of domestic frameworks. There's the King reports on ethical business. Then there is the, internationally, there are the United Nations guiding principles on businesses and human rights. There's also the international, the ICRC framework, which specifically states that states are supposed to have laws in their countries to regulate and to ensure that corporate conduct is not used to violate human rights and break international law. And the thing about South Africa is that we, as a country, have the full framework from international law and how the Constitution binds it in the country, as well as the actual provisions which can be used to stop this export.
Yeah, I think the central takeout from what you just said is that human life and the right to human life trumps profit every single time.
Precisely.
And this is what we need to emphasize. I want to stay with you, Saran, with a follow-up question. The report suggests that failure to act could amount to a form of complicity rather than neutrality. Can you unpack the distinction for our listeners?
Yeah, so this is a critical distinction because neutrality is only possible when you are not contributing to the harm. I think there are differing opinions on this, but my personal view for one is that Israel's very existence is inherently illegal. At the very least, what they've been doing since 1948 is illegal and unconscionable conduct, and any trade to Israel should be considered to be not neutral trade, but forms part of the greater framework and system of recognition which no states should do while there's an ongoing genocide and ongoing illegal occupation. But if you take neutrality as, okay, no harm is being committed, so it must be neutral, then fine. But in this case, once you know about the war crimes and the crimes against humanity and the genocide and the torture, and which is ongoing and continuous, and you continue providing material support such as coal, which feeds Israel's capacity to carry out these crimes, then you are no longer neutral, and this trade is no longer neutral. It directly supports the crimes against humanity, and this trade must be brought to an end. This is again because coal facilitates the conditions that make these violations possible. So in international law, silence combined with continued conduct is in no way neutral. It is complicity by omission or the failure by the state to take action and by the contribution that our coal has to the ongoing these ongoing war crimes.
So we've read this report. And the report makes the connection and charges the government with complicity, highlights the complicity. We intend to have certain outcomes because the report doesn't just stand in the air. It makes some concrete demands. So, Roshan, this is for you. What would meaningful action look like in this context? And what mechanisms are already available to the South African government to hold these exports of coal to this genocidal state?
Well, on the last point, I think the key point of the report is that the tools to act already exist for government. South Africa does not need new laws. It needs to use the ones it has. For example, the International Trade Administration Act allows the Minister of DTIC to restrict exports in the public interest directly on coal where the final destination is Israel. Then there's the National Ports Act, which gives the Minister of Transport authority and control over vessels and cargo operations so we can stop ships coming to our ports, loading our coal and transporting it to Israel. And then under the MPRDA, minerals are held in custodianship for the benefit of the people, not for murdering Palestinians abroad. So if the government used the powers it already has, it could practically suspend and restrict exports, including any permits. It could refuse or delay port access for implicated shipments. And it could also publish policy directives ensuring that there is end-use transparency in coal exports, making sure that no coal is exported to Israel until there is a complete end to the genocide and dismantling of the illegal occupation. So the argument we're making is we have already on our statutes not only the domestication of all of the relevant international law, but also domestic law that supports the government being able to make those decisions. So if, you know, it's not unprecedented that government has used these measures. South Africa already imposed export controls during COVID-19, for example, when there was a public interest imperative, as they called it. Well, we are arguing that there is now again, of course, a public interest imperative to stop us being complicit in genocide and crimes against humanity. So the real question for government is not whether it can act, but whether it is willing to act. But of course, government's not the only role player. And we are also looking at how we can put pressure on Glencore, one of the major coal mining companies, not only in South Africa, but it had been the major coal mining company in Colombia that was exporting coal to Israel before the Colombian government imposed its coal embargo, as well as Africa Rainbow Minerals, which is a shareholder in Glencore, and which, as another mining company, all the mining companies collectively, there's a kind of a consortium that owns Richards Bay Coal Terminal. So they are all actually having a legal obligation to do due diligence. They can't just say they don't know where their coal is going, or it's sold to middlemen, or, you know, and they don't determine where it goes to, or they can't be sure it's their coal. Every company, every corporation, as well as every state, it has a duty to do that due diligence to ensure, okay, if you're not selling, if your coal's not going to Israel, prove it. You have to show that this is not the case. Otherwise, you are still going to be held complicit because somebody's selling the coal. We've been tracking ships as part of the campaign. We've learned a lot of new things, like how to track ships. We've started understanding the law of the sea and all sorts of things that, you know, through trying to see how can we better understand the supply chain, and how can we better understand where, as campaign, to put pressure. So we can see the ships. And right now there's another ship called Genco Courageous that is, we've found now proven that it is coming into Richards Bay to load up with coal, and their capacity is around 167,000 tons. So generally the ships will try to go obviously with as much of a full cargo as possible, and these ships are flagging themselves. You can see it's publicly accessible information from Richards Bay and by which berth they dock in. You can see that it's the coal terminal, and they're flagged to go to either Hadera port in Israel or Ashkelon. That this last one, Genco Courageous, is saying Hadera and or Ashkelon, possibly because there have been explosions from the Iranian military on installations quite close to the port of Hadera. And of course, you know, they've also been targeting energy infrastructure in retaliation to Israel targeting their oil infrastructure and so on. So we can see now the ships are not quite sure, but definitely they're headed for Israel with our coal. So as part of the campaign, and I think that's also what brings us here, it's about finding out, you know, doing the research, finding out exactly what's happening with our coal sales, finding out where to start putting the pressure, how we can put that pressure, and building a campaign that's intersectional, because these issues, as you, Comrade Sunny, know very well from the climate justice movement, and as we're here today on a climate justice activist podcast, it's not just the issues around the coal sales going to Israel that are making us complicit. If you look at what's been recorded and reported by Palestinians as an ecocide, the amount of tonnage of explosives that have been dropped on Gaza have created an ecological catastrophe that is going to last for generations and doesn't just affect that small strip of the Gaza Strip, obviously, as we know. It's all interconnected in global chains of extractivism. So companies like Glencore, we have joined with, for instance, the Resist Glencore Network, which is activists all around the world, who also have taken up the issue of the energy embargo against Israel, but are also taking action in different ways, from Peru to Switzerland, where Glencore is headquartered, on different aspects of the atrocities this particular company, the largest commodity trader in the world, is committing. And Glencore has its roots in apartheid South Africa too, by the way. So it's also looking at the corporations. It's trying to build intersectional campaigning, also with mining affected communities who immediately understand the consequences of extractivism, and with trade unions, and making the argument with trade unions in particular that by us implementing a coal embargo, it will not have a negative effect on our economy or our coal exports or mining industry in terms of job losses, because it's such a very small amount of our coal that goes to Israel, yet it makes up quite a large percentage of Israel's energy mix. So it has a big impact on them if we stop, but it has a very small impact, a negligible. In fact, it won't mean job losses or mine closures or any of those things. It will be taken up by other purchases. I think the legal track is one thing, but to take legal action without having a broader campaign, raising it up in the media, social media, trying to build a movement as well for a sustainable and long-term sustained boycott, divestments and sanctions movement is all part of what we're trying to do with the legal case as well.
Thank you, Roshan, for that response, and thank you for connecting the dots to ecocide and to the climate justice catastrophe that's unfolding. As a climate justice activist myself, I'm painfully aware of the emissions footprint of the global military industrial complex, and this is evident in Palestine. I want to go back to your answer about Glencore. Remind us who the chief shareholder is of Africa Rainbow Minerals.
It's Patrice Motsepe, who is now, according to the polls of ANC supporters, the number one choice to become the next president of the African National Congress and therefore be in line to be president of the country. He is someone who also has invited the totally discredited chief rabbi to address his enormous prayer gatherings. That's Patrice's enormous annual prayer gatherings that he has in Soweto. Thousands of people come. And the last year he invited the chief rabbi, who even some of the Zionists in South Africa are beginning to find a little too much for their tastes, to address the thousands of people in Soweto at this prayer gathering. So I think, you know, we have actually gone into Africa Rainbow Minerals AGM and asked him directly a question about the coal sales to Israel. He answered with a whole lot of waffle, including a lot of nonsense about religion. And of course, we know this is not a religious conflict. I think definitely we have him in particular in our sights to really put pressure on him, especially as Africa Rainbow Minerals is supposed to be, you know, in a way, a kind of a flagship BEE company in the mining, in the mining community, if you can call it a community. That's Patrice Motsepe.
Yeah, thank you. It's important because what we are doing is we're naming the key players, we're naming the actors, and we're gathering evidence. Mm. This is why it's important to name who the perpetrators and to name those that are complicit and charged with complicity. So I think I want to say a big thank you to our guests, Roshan Dadu and Saran Sheikhan, for sharing their time, insight, and critical analysis with us. I'm going to give you each one an opportunity just to wrap up and give us your final thoughts. We'll go with Saran first and then come back to Roshan.
Thanks for having us. I think just in closing, the main message we want to get out is that we want support from as many organizations, locally, internationally, legal, trade unions, community groups, and to all pretty much come together and support this campaign, because it is one which is right and just in law. It is a campaign that is very long overdue. I mean, South Africa should have taken this action as far back as January 2024. In fact, even at the time that they launched the ICJ application, I think on the 29th of December 2023, around then they should have immediately put a stop to any coal exports with the power that they have. They should, in addition to these actions, also ensure that in all dealings with this genocidal apartheid regime, all contact needs to be cut off. All any South Africans that are found to be operating in the IOF should be investigated and prosecuted, and you know, there's a whole broad there's quite a broad array of actions that South Africa needs to take in order to meet its obligations apart from these coal exports. And yeah, so we are really calling on people and organizations to support this campaign, and then also to come out and see how we can ensure that we kick this Zionazi state out of our borders.
Yeah, it's unconscionable to me that there are South Africans that are serving in the IOF, and soldiers from South Africa that participate in the genocide. We know that civil society organizations, pro-Palestinian organizations, have provided the government and the NPA with a long list of these names, mm-hmm. and civil society must call for the NPA to follow up on those cases. Those cases are part of the evidence record, and comprehensively, as comprehensive as this report is, there's something termed the Gaza docket that highlights mm-hmm. this. We must also make sure that the Gaza docket gets the relevant attention, because there are South Africans serving in the IOF today. Roshan, your closing remarks.
Yep, just on that point, we also have a petition, both a hard copy petition that's going to be submitted to Parliament, but also an online petition to back that up. And the demands there are around the coal embargo and also the question of prosecuting South Africans that join the Israeli occupation forces, which is in contravention of our domestic laws as well as international law. But I also just wanted to end with a favorite quote of mine from Samora Machel, who said, "Solidarity isn't charity. Solidarity is people fighting on different terrains for the same objective." And I think that's something that Francesca Albanese, the special rapporteur on the occupied Palestinian territories, brought out in her report, From the Economy of Occupation to the Economy of Genocide. And it's something that connects the struggles we are suffering and having to undertake still here in South Africa around land, around unemployment, and so on. Because it's the underpinning, what Francesca Albanese called a racist colonial capitalist economy, that she highlights in that report, that is what's driving both the profit-making imperative that compels companies, that also then puts states into this position of being complicit, even though they should be exercising these regulatory power, you know, regulatory mechanisms that they have. So I think we also are facing that. And in fact, Francesca Albanese, soon after into her first mandate, said that South Africa dismantled apartheid, but it didn't dismantle the underlying system of settler colonialism and the economy that underpins that. And I think that is what's important, and where our struggles are directly connected for climate justice, for land, for housing, for jobs, for a decent life for all, here in South Africa, in our continent, across the world. And Palestine is a litmus test. If we allow this to continue, if we allow the Zionist state of Israel to continue with its acting with impunity, throwing away international law with the help of its friend America, who's just thrown away the rule book around even the rules that there are around committing wars, then I think we are all going to lose our struggles. So if we can together, you know, put this pressure on our governments, if we can make sure that they stick to what they say they are going to do and do it, then I think it's beneficial for all of us in all of our struggles.
What a powerful way to end, Roshan. So I'm going to talk to the listeners right now. If this conversation resonated with you, then follow the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement on social media to stay informed and to find ways to take action, because your agency and your ability to take action is very, very powerful. We link our pages in the description, and we will also link a copy of the report that we have referenced today. And of course, don't forget to subscribe to this podcast. Share the episode with your community and keep these conversations going, because accountability doesn't happen in silence. So I want to thank everybody for their participation today, but also to the listeners for taking the time to listen. Watch out for our next episode. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. Free Palestine.
Thank you for listening to Just Us and the Climate, a production of the Climate Justice Coalition. To find out more about the coalition and our work to advance climate justice, visit climatejusticecoalition.org. If you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe and share it widely. The more people it reaches, the more we can help grow the movement for climate justice. This podcast is made possible thanks to the financial support of the Open Society Foundation.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.